If I were less nervous, I would have jumped up there. I'm Blanche, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I am nervous. You know, I just asked Don a little while ago, I said, "Do you still get nervous?" And he said, "Yeah." But I know I must know my story because I was there for most of it. I say prayers in the morning and at night now, and I've been doing that for a long time. I heard a good version of the Serenity Prayer that I use a lot, which is, "God, help me not to be an asshole today." You know, because that certainly describes how I behaved when I was drinking. I would have told you, you know, people I think like to know how long somebody's been sober and how old they are. Well, you know, I'm 42, and I've been sober 6 years, sober and drug free. I would have told you up until a couple of years ago that I grew up in a normal family, a statement which I now think is hysterical. If you met my family, you know, I am really the only normal one. I mean that. I am the only normal. But I didn't see drinking growing up. My father had a drinking problem, but it was kept from me. I was left with an uncle a lot, who was an active alcoholic and an abusive man. When I began to remember being abused by this uncle in the last year or so, I called my sister and I said, "Were you afraid of Uncle Dusty?" And that was the sound. My sister and I are pretty honest with each other, and she said, "No." She said, "But I do remember the cattle prod. You know, he used to chase us around the house with the cattle prod and stuff like that." And I was terrified of him. When I was 5, I fell out of a truck and cracked my skull, and he came running down the steps to pick me up, and I crawled away from him. That's what I did. He was the terrifying figure of my childhood. Anyway, this is all sort of going to be out of order. When I was 13, my father was killed in an automobile accident. And what had been a pretty, you know, I was a screwed up little kid anyway. Because, well, you know, this uncle was abusive, and I was told over and over they loved me, and I knew something didn't add up about that. And, you know, basically it's the same old story. What I saw, I was told I didn't see. What I felt, I was told I didn't feel. And by the time I was 6 years old, I was furious and pretty crazy. And what I decided was, I was told over and over that I made things up. And I've made a career out of that. That's what I do for a living. I make things up. I write fiction, and I teach writing fiction. You know, I turned it around being told that. The other thing I remember is being dragged around by my little arms, you know, and to make me walk before I was old enough to walk. And them saying, "Oh, is she normal? Is she normal?" You know. And I feel like they got what they deserve. We got a lesbian overachiever, you know? Alcoholic, drug addict, you know. Anyway, when my father was killed, my family got really messed up, and in an overt way. And not only my father went off to work, and I never saw him again. He was killed in an automobile accident. And my mother shut down completely. We were prescribed tranquilizers, my mother and I, by a doctor, and it was a liquid tranquilizer that I think was something like NyQuil. It, you know, had a sedative, and it was alcohol based. And that was when I discovered what alcohol and drugs could do for me. And my mother didn't take much of this stuff, but I was still renewing the prescription when I got married 5 years later. I drank a bottle of it when I got married, and I don't really remember much about getting married. I do remember that I think I got married in a wig. Because I have some memory of taking it off. Later. Not yet. In the honeymoon suite in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, one of the nightmares of my life. I got married a virgin, but not by choice. We kept trying, and always one of us couldn't. And I think we got married so we could practice, you know, without my mother interfering. She was not happy about me meeting this man, who seemed to me very much like my father. He wore grown-up shoes, you know, the kind of black shoes that lace up. And I had never gone out with somebody who wore shoes like that. And I was in love, you know. I thought I wasn't going to get up here and be funny. I drank alcoholically really from the time I began to take those tranquilizers. I drank and got drunk. I drank and threw up. I drank and fell down. I felt like maturity was going to be when I got to where I could drink and handle drinking. And it never occurred to me that there might be some reason why I couldn't handle alcohol. I just thought I hadn't gotten mature enough and that I would. And I went to college early. I said I was an overachiever. I went to college at, I'd been 17 for about a week when I got to college. And I drank. And I got asked to leave after 2 years. And that's when I got married. But, you know, alcohol began to cost me something serious when I got to college, because I couldn't do it and drink, and I chose to drink. I didn't know I was making a choice. Again, I kept thinking, next time I'll handle it. Next time I won't throw up in somebody's car, you know. It was humiliating. The man I married wouldn't put up with my drinking. You know, it was like, okay, now we're married, now we're grown-ups, and you don't do this shit. And I was real happy, because here was somebody who seemed to understand the rules about life and who laid them down to me. And in the 7 years that I was married from the age of 18 to the age of 25. We drank a little wine with dinner, you know, because we were like California kind of, I guess, yuppies. That's what we were. But in the years that I was married, I went back to college. I graduated with high honors. I went to graduate school at Stanford, and I did a lot of things that really, I accomplished a lot. I learned a lot. I found out that maybe I didn't know so much. I didn't know anything. And I went to school and I studied and I wrote. I thought that if I could be a writer, that I wouldn't be like other people. The same things wouldn't happen to me, that I would be a kind of star in my own mind, and I wouldn't be from where I was from, and the things that had happened to me would mean something different from what they meant, and that I would have some dignity. So that's what I wanted to do, and I set out to do it, and I did it. I wrote it, you know, I got a fancy grant, I did this writing stuff, and I was good at it. I was terrified of it. Terror. That's what I remember of the years that I was not drinking, is being terrified and testing myself. And most of the time, I came through with flying colors, but I wrote this novel, and then I couldn't sell it, and I failed. And that was coupled with a number of things. I did sell it eventually, but it was 2 years before I was able to sell it. I also fell in love with my best friend, who was not a man. And, you know, I really thought, this is the worst thing I have ever done. This is the end of everything. There is no coming back from this. My husband was real reasonable about it. He said, you know, I think she's very attractive. I'm attracted to her. I don't understand what you're so upset about. Well, I guess I knew it was the end of my passing as a normal person, you know? I mean, in that world. And anyway, all that stuff happened at once. I went off to join the revolution in Boston and lived in a lesbian commune and took about 50 LSD trips, bought psilocybin back. I bought 60 caps once and took them all. And not at once. It took me about a month, I think. And I was spray painting slogans on the sides of buses. I wish I could remember some of what I spray painted on buses. And I was trying to learn to steal for the revolution, you know, and all this crap. God. And the truth was, I was being led around by my crotch. That is just the truth. You know, I can't say that in a straight meeting, and that's you know, I was just in love with one woman after another, and just gaga. You know, we go spray paint buses now, okay. We're in the revolution now, okay. We're in a we're arrested now, okay. That's what I was doing. And after about a year, I was living in this lesbian commune, and I went off to Vermont for the weekend, and when I came back, half the group had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you can imagine what I thought about that. And they told me I had a drinking problem. This was 1971, I guess. And I went to a meeting to prove I was not afraid. And then I moved to Vermont. I hated AA. I hated it. I couldn't believe they were sitting around talking about God as a man. That they were sitting around talking about God at all. That they had, the meeting I went to was in the basement of a church. I thought, you know, this is a long way from being arrested in a demonstration. You know? And I just couldn't get away fast enough. So I moved to Vermont. I had some mixed up years there. I guess I was already mixed up. But things got, they'd get a little bit better and then they'd get a lot worse, you know. I moved to Vermont. By this time I could hold my liquor, you know. I didn't throw up anymore. I didn't even seem drunk. You know, I could drink and drink and drink and drink. And I was very proud of how much I could drink and the fact that I didn't fall down. And when I started to slur my words, I got quiet. And, you know, I was a good person to drink with. And I could drive drinking. Y'all all know about closing your eyes so you can see which white line is the right white line. And anyway, from there I ended up what did I do? I tried to kill myself. That's what I did. I took a bunch of aspirin because this woman rejected me. Took 105 aspirin or something like that, with a bottle of brandy, and I ended up in the hospital with my stomach pumped. I think I was numb, you know. I felt dead inside, and I think I took the aspirin as a way of trying to feel something. Well, y'all, I woke up in the hospital and I felt something. And it was not good, because when I woke up in the hospital, I did want to die. And I had never really felt like that. It scared me real bad. And I was so messed up. One friend wrote another friend's phone number up my arm in magic marker and put me on the train in New York to see my shrink. And I had to be picked up at Penn Station because I couldn't get a cab. That's the kind of shape I was in. I stayed in New York a few days, and then I went back and finished my job. I was teaching in Vermont. And the next year was real bad, real bad. You know, I didn't know whether I was in the post office or the laundromat. I really didn't. And I was afraid people were going to figure out I didn't know where I was and lock me up. And I was afraid of being locked up because I was a lesbian. And I was afraid if anybody tried to make me deal with that, that I might kill myself. It was one thing when I fell in love with my friend and had all these beautiful feelings that I had never experienced. And it was another thing when I found myself picking up people in bars and basically trying to get rid of my sexuality. And now I see it as acting from a place where I hated myself. I hated myself. And that's what that was all about. Anyway, my life settled down some. I met a woman who was married. I bring that up because after we broke up, she got married again. And she left her husband, and we moved in together, and my life got stable. It stayed stable for about 5 or 6 years. She didn't drink much. You know, I lived in New York. I had a shrink. I gave dinner parties. I wrote another book. Everything seemed okay, you know. But I was still drinking every day, and I began to smoke dope every day. And I don't guess I was into pills yet. But I would say from like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, sometimes as late as 5, I'd check out. And that's what I call it. That's what I would call it. I'm checking out. I'd have a drink, light a joint, and I was gone. And, you know, I couldn't even talk on the phone. And I thought that was reasonable behavior, you know. Don't call me right now. I'm stoned, you know. I don't want to talk to you. I don't know what I'm saying. And I thought that was okay. And it got slowly worse. And when my relationship with this woman ended, I had thought, you know, when the first book came out, I didn't feel any better. I felt worse. That's when I took the aspirin. And I thought if I wrote a second book, this time it was going to work. This time I was really going to be different. I was going to feel better. I would have somehow expressed my pain to the world, and it would be out of me and y'all's problem. That's what I thought. If I could write a book, it wouldn't be my problem anymore. So I wrote a second book, and it came out about the same time that Just Lover and I broke up, and I had another breakdown. That's what happened. I went, I came completely unglued again. I was living in a hotel full of really, really, really old people in New York, and like in their 90s, and who had no relatives, and it was depressing. I was depressed. It was the right place to be, I guess. Anyway, one of my old writing teachers saw a piece that I wrote in a magazine and said, he wrote me a letter, and he was really angry, and he said, you know, you have real talent, and you are throwing it away, and you ought to go home. You don't know what you're writing about anymore. And I went home. My drinking had started to outstrip my friends' drinking in New York by quite a bit, and I was no longer holding it together. Now sometimes I did socially unacceptable things when I was drinking, like cut my wrist in an argument. I didn't know I was going to do it. I didn't have any idea. I was cutting up a chicken in the sink, and my lover was giving me a hard time, and I turned around and I said, you think you feel so bad, you know, watch this, you know? And I didn't have any idea that I was going to do that I felt that way. I went to therapy. I said, this isn't working, you know? You're not helping me. Look what I did. I didn't get it sewed up because I had some inkling that if I went to a hospital with this cut, again, I might be locked up. Again, I might have to deal with being a lesbian and a lot of other stuff. But that seemed to me the most frightening issue. And another time I went through the house and killed all the plants when I was drunk. I tore them out of their little boxes, you know. I got up in the morning, there was dirt everywhere, and my little spider plants were all lying on the side. You know, a lot of them lived, you know. I replanted them. That's a good illustration of how foolish I was, how melodramatic I was, and how much pain I was in. Because all of those things are in that little scene. I was trying to control my violence and my pain. I was trying to not hurt somebody else and not hurt myself, and I didn't know how to get that stuff out. I was always either drunk when this stuff started or drunk by the time it was over. And then I moved back to South Carolina, and I met a bunch of women who drank the way I thought the people should drink, and one of whom I'm here with this weekend. And my drinking got a lot worse real fast. And my drugging got a lot worse real fast. And I guess it all sort of culminated in a friend of mine and I bought 100 preludes together. 66 for me and 34 for her. Because I had a lover and I had to share mine. And And she went home that night and shot herself on these clothes. And she's sober now. I like to bring that up real fast. But I don't know if y'all have ever seen anybody shot, but it is just horrible. It is truly horrible. And when I saw that, I had a moment of real clarity. You know, there are moments when you see yourself, you see your life, and you know this is a turning point. And I knew right then that the game was over of that drinking. I knew that it wasn't cool, it wasn't fun, we were dying. That's what this was about. We were dying. And my friend, all that she did was have the guts to call the game. That's all she did. Now, that was at Thanksgiving. And I didn't get sober till, I didn't go to AA till March. Somebody told me that they heard a tape of me speaking, and I said that the reason I didn't do that was that I had to take the rest of the Quaaludes. And that's right. That's why I didn't, I knew I couldn't do anything till the Quaaludes were finished. And I was hallucinating a lot. It was bad. I was living with one of my students who was 12 years younger than me, who had been straight, and who I had plied with drugs and alcohol. And one night, what actually precipitated me going to an AA meeting was that I tore up the apartment because she wrote on the cover of a magazine of mine. She wrote a phone number on it, her father's phone number. He was in town. Her parents were in town. And I picked up a piece of furniture like I was the Hulk and smashed it. And I started attacking her. You know, character assassination? Most of us have either done it or been on the receiving end of it. You know, just an absolute attack on who she was, what she was like. And again, I had a kind of moment where I saw this person would have to leave me. I saw that anyone with a shred of self-respect was going to have to leave me. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to AA. That would mix everything up for a while. And I might, it would seem so penitent, you know, that maybe she wouldn't leave. You know, it would really confuse her. I knew that. It was just absolutely outrageous, I did. So I went to an AA meeting. It was in the courtroom at in this little town, and people were sitting in the jury box and stuff, you know. Back then, you know, I used to wear these big old leather cowboy boots and this big old black leather coat that came down to my knees. My hair was out to here, and I went around in dark glasses, and I thought I looked really cool, you know. Anyway, I went to the AA meeting. I wrote everything down because that was the only way I could remember anything by that point. And people thought I was a nurse. I can't imagine why they thought I was a nurse. I just wanted to stay, you know. It's like, these were all kind of suburban people like my parents, but there was a kind of way that they were with each other that I found extremely attractive. They looked right at me. They looked right at each other. They seemed calm. They seemed happy. It was like a kind of light that I was drawn to. I just wanted to stay there. And I asked somebody, I said, can I come to these meetings and still drink? And the guy was only sober 6 months, and he didn't know the answer to the question. So he said, I don't know. So I said, okay, I'll stop, you know, because I was afraid they were going to tell me I couldn't stay there. And but I didn't know how to stop. So this guy I thought was the leader. I had a lot of trouble understanding there weren't any leaders in AA. He told me, he said, can you stop for one day? And I said, sure. And he said, okay, you meet me tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And he told me this place to meet him. And he said, don't have a drink or a drug. Actually, he said, don't have a drink. I didn't know about the drugs thing. I didn't hear it for a long time. And I went to that meeting. I went late so nobody would talk to me. And he was chairing it. again, made me certain he was the leader. And he had an empty chair beside him, and he patted it, and I went up and sat down. And you know when he said, "Did you have a drink today?" And I said, "No." And he said, "I didn't either." No. He said, "That's the whole thing." He said, "You've got it. That's all you have to do." He said, "Don't have a drink every day. Go to a meeting, and you'll be all right." No. That was plain enough for me to understand. I could understand what he was saying. And you know, early sobriety interested me a lot because it was so awful. Now, I'm not very interested in moderation. That is still true of me, you know. AA was the most extreme thing I had. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was so extreme. It was more extreme than being in the radical women's movement and spray painting. You know? I mean, yeah, we were going to be alcoholics. We were not going to drink. And I began to realize that they meant it about these steps. You know, this wasn't like a church where they say something that they don't believe and pass the basket. It wasn't. They weren't kidding. They weren't kidding. And I thought, this is really something. Now, these people think they go live like this. This is really something. I was fascinated, you know, like, would it be possible to do something this hard? I hadn't gone a day without a drink or a drug in at least 11 years. And, you know, the idea that I could actually not do it, you know. So I was interested in it. They told me what to do, so I stayed home and I cried and I whined and I crawled around the apartment and I ate candy and I drank Gatorade and I hallucinated and, you know. I'd had all this therapy, you know. I had had lots of therapy. And I was in withdrawal, and I was maybe 3 or 4 days, and my lover was washing the dishes, and it started sounding like machine gun fire, and I was standing there like this, and I said, "I know what I'll do. I'll call this guy, the leader." You know, I called the leader, and I said, "He's washing the dishes, and it sounds like machine gun fire." And I expected him to say, you know, "What are your associations with machine gun fire?" Instead, he said, "Is there something you could listen to that would make you feel better?" You know, 6 years of therapy turned on its head. Right? So I said, "Well," I said, "I live across the street from the beach. I could go listen to the ocean, you know." And he said, "Well, why don't you go listen to the ocean? You'll probably feel better." I don't want to tell him that I was scared to cross the street. But I went out and stood on the balcony and I listened to the ocean. And I felt better. You know, the idea that I didn't have to figure out what was wrong with me, you know, that I could not drink one day at a time, but maybe I'd find out there wasn't so much wrong with me. I didn't believe that drinking was my problem. I believed that I was an extremely sensitive artist, stormy and temperamental, and that this was the cost of my creativity. And but drinking was ruining my body, which concerned me a lot. And I could see that I really needed to stop it. I had no intention of stopping drugs when I came to AA. None. And I figured as soon as I felt better, I would start to do drugs. That's what I did. And, you know, just a little bit. I couldn't sleep. My sponsor said nobody ever died of lack of sleep. And, but, you know, I couldn't stand the anxiety at night. I really just wasn't, I wasn't prepared to give up drugs. If I'd have known AA meant I had to give up drugs, I don't think I'd have gone, you know. Not when I did. But I did, I had a marijuana slip, a pill slip. One by one, my sponsor would say, "Now, you could drink if you don't stop this," so I'd stop it. I didn't know it was an AA slip. Or I might have gotten drunk. I don't know. But the last thing I did was cocaine, and I did it for about 5 days, and I did it around the clock, and or all the time I was awake. And, you know, I thought that AA was very unsophisticated about drugs. That was my opinion, that I just knew all the stuff about drugs. And, you know, everybody in AA drank coffee and smoked cigarettes. And I didn't smoke cigarettes, and I certainly didn't see what was wrong with smoking dope, you know. And anyway, when I came off of cocaine, 5 days after I came off of cocaine, I had a psychotic break from coming off of cocaine. You know, I don't think I'd have ever gotten into cocaine if I hadn't been told that it was not addictive. And I told somebody a year later about this minor break with reality that I had here. And she said, oh yeah, cocaine psychosis, we see it all the time. You know? I mean, she was a therapist. And I thought, you know, I didn't know what was happening to me when it happened to me. If I had known what was happening when it started, I would have gone to a hospital. But by the time it was full blown, I really could not go to a hospital. I was too paranoid. And it lasted about 36 hours. I think it was the beginning of real compassion for myself, because part of me was across the room watching me screaming and carrying on and saying I was going to kill myself. And the other part of me was across the room thinking, what is wrong with her? What is wrong with her? Help! Somebody's got to help this person. That was me getting outside myself finally. And that was the beginning, I think, of me recovering, for me to understand that this person who was suffering so much was not all of me. There was another part of me. So everybody knows what early recovery is like. And it's not fun, but it is interesting. And, you know, at 90 days, I thought I had graduated, and because I felt better. And, you know, you feel better, and you start to think, I'm not really an alcoholic. This was all a bad dream. And but I had been warned that that would happen, and I didn't drink or do a drug. There are milestones in my recovery, turning points. There were two things I didn't say when I came into AA. One was that I was a writer, and the other was that I was gay. I got sober in South Carolina, and I was pretty sure I was the only gay person who was sober in South Carolina. I knew there were a lot of people who drank, but I thought I was the only sober one, or the only one trying to get sober. And that was pretty much true. There weren't many people, many gay people getting sober. We now have a gay meeting. But it was... you know, the topic would be honesty, and I would go home and cry myself to sleep. I just knew that these people, if they found out I was gay, that all this mouthing about honesty would come unraveled before my eyes. I would lose my belief in AA, and I would be back where I started. So, I didn't want to say I couldn't take the risk. And the other thing, I began to realize after a while that I went to all the meetings with my lover. Everybody knew I was gay. It was obvious, you know. And I began to realize that I was the one. I was the one who had the problem with being gay. These people didn't have a problem with me being gay. I did. And that I thought people wouldn't like me, that I needed approval, that I thought that being gay was wrong, that I had somewhere bought into the idea that I was sick, that there was a cause for why I was gay, and someday I was going to get well, an idea that my family still clings to. And, a couple of years ago, I asked my mother to buy me a skirt, and she said, oh, don't do this for me. They really try, you know, they really do try. I didn't say I was gay because I thought it made me worse, and I didn't say I was a writer because I thought it made me better, you know, because I had such an invested idea that being a writer was somehow, you weren't a person anymore, you were a writer, you know, and this was an idea that I had suffered terribly over, and it is amazing that I was still clinging to it, but I was. And once I was sitting in a meeting reading the galleys of a book, and this guy I respect a whole lot came over to me and he said, what you reading? And I said, you know, the galleys of a book look different from a regular book, and it's the proofs before the book is printed. And it was a way of saying, I'm important and I read galleys. And so I'm sitting there reading these galleys, and he comes over and he asks me what they are, and I tell him, and he says, I have never known anyone too dumb to get sober. He said, but I have known many people too smart. Make sure you're not one of them. That was very good advice. And my sponsor, I got a sponsor real fast, who said to me, she said, "Keep it simple, stupid," was one of the first things she said to me. And I was thrilled. No one had ever called me stupid in my life. And I knew it was true. She said, "You didn't get here by being smart, so forget what you know. It's only gotten you in trouble." And that was right. You know, it was right. I had never let myself be taught until I got into AA. I had never listened to anyone. Why should I? The authority figures I grew up around were demented. You know, they were sick. What they told me about me wasn't true. But when I got in AA, what people were telling me to do was right. And it was based on helping me get well. And it wasn't based on... it was love. It was love. That's what it was. And I didn't know what to call it, but I knew it. I felt it. I felt it. I like to say that love is about listening to somebody and not trying to fix it. You know? And in AA, people listen to what hurts. And they don't try to fix you. And they don't try to say, "Oh, it's not real." And they don't try to say, "Oh, everything will be all right." And they don't try to say, "Oh, it doesn't matter." You know? They let you be upset. Then you're not upset. And it works. You know, it really works. And in AA was the first time that I think I have been truly loved in that sense. I was accepted. And then the problem became, how was I going to accept myself? Because that was hard. Finally, when I'd been sober a year, I got up on New Year's Eve. I was the speaker. And I said I was gay, and I cried. And, you know, no one fell out of their chairs. No one threw up. No one ran out of the room. It was fine. It was fine. It was part of my story, I thought. That was all. And that was great for me. That was the kind of acceptance I didn't have at home that I had never imagined. I really hadn't imagined that. It wasn't that they didn't have problems with it. Of course they did, you know. It was that what they cared about was me and my sobriety. And if I needed to get up and say I was gay, that was fine. They weren't going to give me a hard time about that. So I began to... somebody told me to pray on my knees. I started doing that. I really did not want to do that. You know, I felt like people were looking at me. I'm home alone, right? But I feel like somebody's watching me. You know, it was me watching me. It was me seeing this as humiliation. And, you know, it's an ancient posture of humility. That's what being on your knees is. It's got nothing to do with Christianity. It's got nothing to do with being a Baptist. It's got nothing to do with any of that. It has to do with, for me, opening myself up to experience God and to listen and to tell the truth. And I try to do that with my higher power. I've been through a lot about spiritual things. And, you know, I like in the 11th step where it says to improve our conscious contact with God. The idea that we're trying to improve our conscious contact implies that we've been in unconscious contact all along. And I like that idea. I like the idea God doesn't turn me loose, I turn God loose. And I try to stay clear about that. Sometimes I lose my faith. I've gotten clear that faith is not a feeling. So if I lose it, it's okay. Faith is a decision. It's a decision I made when I took the third step. It doesn't say in the third step, turn our life and our will over to God. It says, made a decision to turn our life and our will over to God. Over to the care of God. All of that, the other thing in the steps I like to point out is that it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It doesn't say as a result, it says as the result. You know? That's amazing. That's quite a promise. That's quite a promise that if you work the steps, you're going to have a spiritual awakening. Now, you know how it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? I, of course, assumed I was the rare one. You know? And that I wouldn't, everybody was going to get it but me. I wouldn't get it. But I kind of hoped that statistics would be on my side. about this. I heard that Dr. Bob said if he could change one word in the big book, he would have changed rarely to never. But then I heard a different story about it, that he said if they'd have changed rarely to never, somebody would have gone out and gotten drunk just to prove that it's wrong. That seems right, too. I didn't do the fourth step till I was sober 2.5 years. Because, see, I'm a writer. And writing stuff to me means something different from what it means to you, you know. I'm a teacher, so, you know, it's like, I wasn't going to do it. I told my sponsor and my lover every bad thing I had ever done, and I thought that was the fourth step. That wasn't the fourth step, although I do think it was probably helpful. When I finally did, this guy said to me, he said, I was explaining to him why I didn't have to do the fourth step in writing. And he said, well, you know, he said, that's fine for you. He said, but I did it the way I was told to do it. He said, I wouldn't trade how I feel for anything in the world. And that was not how I felt. I would have traded how I felt for how he felt in a heartbeat, you know. I could see the difference in how he felt and how I felt. So I started doing the fourth step. It wasn't long, you know, because I was so eaten up with resentment. I was really eaten up with resentment. And, you know, somebody got me once to make a list of the people I had loved the most, who had meant the most to me in my life, and to make a list of the people I had resented the most in my life, the top three. Two were the same. So what that meant was, watch out if I love you, because sooner or later I'm going to hate you. You know, that was my history. I hated all of my ex-lovers. I mean, big time. I had a hit list, you know, people that I would like to see run over my trucks and stuff. And, you know, I had sort of based my character. I didn't think of myself as a victim person. I thought of myself as a vengeance person. I would wait a long time to settle a score. And I was proud to be like that. You know, I was proud to be the kind of person who, you know, if you did something to me sooner or later, if I ever got the chance, I'd get you back. And, you know, what's underneath that is victim. That's what's underneath that. But I couldn't look at that because that's too scary. But doing the fourth step, I got all this, you know, crap out. And I had this nice little straight lady sponsor who I was going to do my fifth step with, and I go down there and read this thing. And, you know, it was my big moment. I'm sitting there crying and telling her all the stuff I'd done. We're sitting in her kitchen, and her kids are coming in and saying, Mommy, can I have a popsicle? And stuff like that. It was not the drama that I thought. And at the end of it, she said, I know how you feel. And I thought, is that possible that this woman knows how I feel? And she did. She was able to relate to my tales of horrors. She was able to relate from her own experience to it. And the feelings were the same. And I began to see all of my horror stories as mere details. Mere details. That's all they were. They were just my little story. Not special, not different. And I gave up a lot of my specialness when I did the fourth step. And it felt great. And when I see this woman in a meeting, I feel this kind of warmth toward her that's wonderful. I want to just talk a little bit more about what happened in my fifth year of sobriety. I began to achieve about fourth and fifth year a lot of calmness, a lot of success in my career. And something was missing. I didn't know what it was. I was also sexually dysfunctional when I sobered up, which was pretty upsetting to me. And that stayed true for a long time. And I knew that if I allowed to say that, if I allowed myself to drink over it, it would never, you know, I really had to settle it with myself. If I never write another word, if I never have sex again, I'm not going to drink or do a drug. That's just going to be the way it is. And yeah, I wish I could say that all that got straightened out in like 3 weeks or something, but it didn't. And the fourth step straightened a lot of it out because I had so much guilt. I had so much shame. I had so many things I had done that I was certain were different and horrible, and they weren't. And so a lot of that began to heal. But I did begin to realize that maybe there wasn't something sexually wrong with me. Maybe I was not living with a person that I was sexually attracted to. And that was real scary, because I had been with this person for, well, we were together 6 years. And I had been sexually attracted to her, and I felt real when I was drinking. And I felt terrible to realize that I was not, that this was not the right situation for me. And I thought, well, you've got to make the best of this. You can't. And I didn't want to touch my own abandonment feelings and all that stuff. My bargain with God was, I will stay sober and you don't touch this relationship. You know? And that was what I got for a long time. But when I was 5 years sober, I began to go through a kind of internal revolution. I began to realize that I was never going to write again if I couldn't get out of this relationship. And I didn't know why that was true. I knew I had to live alone, that I had not lived alone. And I went to Peru to be initiated by a shaman. I felt not connected with God. And so I did this outrageous thing. And I came back wanting to do drugs really bad. Really, with my sobriety hanging by a thread, I had my 5th anniversary in Lima with the shaman, you know. And, you know, I just needed my experience of God to be more positive and to be stronger than it was being. And in the last year, I've tried to work on that. I've also started going to ACOA to try to deal with, you know, the 4th step let me deal with what I did. But it's been very frightening for me to deal with what was done to me, what was done when I was actually helpless. In a way, it's been easier for me to say, yeah, I'm bad, I did these things. In a way, that's been easier than for me to say, terrible things happened to me as a child and I couldn't do anything about it. And to go through those feelings has been real scary, but incredibly rewarding to go through. And I feel... I feel very good inside. Whatever it was in here that, you know, I felt like somewhere way down deep, I was a bad person. I did something wrong. I don't know what it was, but I was going to have to spend my life making up for it. And I didn't know that's where I was operating from. And I don't feel that way anymore. I know that, you know, I'm a good person inside. And what felt so very dark right at the center of me feels light now. It doesn't feel dark. And that has to do with conscious contact. It has to do with that, with prayer and meditation, and with being willing to go through some of these feelings that have been so excruciating to go through. I had to take out the garbage before there was room, really, for some of this other stuff. If I hadn't joined AA, I would be, I hope I would be dead, but maybe I wouldn't be that lucky, you know? I think I would, my pattern was to be crazy. I probably would be in a hospital. But, you know, I might be in jail. I don't know. But I did come to AA. And I'm lucky enough to have listened. And I'm lucky enough to not graduate, which is something that I try to do periodically. You know, I was told there's 2 times to go to meetings, when you want to and when you don't. And that works for me. That's when I go. And which means I go pretty much all the time. The more I go to AA, the better I feel. And I think it's because there's something that happens in these rooms that is very much like conscious contact. You know, we come in here, we go out, we don't know why we feel better. I tried so hard to figure it out. You know, I can't figure it out. But I know it's in here. You know, anytime you put alcoholics together and start a meeting, you know, God is there. That's just, I think that's why it works. Bill Wilson said that, you know, alcoholics had a crushing ego experience, which allowed them to have a spiritual awakening. I'm paraphrasing it, but that's the general idea. You know, the only book mentioned in the big book is Varieties of Religious Experience by William James, which is an interesting book to read because it's about different kinds of spiritual awakenings, you know. And because I was worried when I had a spiritual awakening, maybe I wouldn't do it right, you know. I went to a guru for my spiritual awakening. And lucky me, it was wonderful for me. Lucky me in every way, you know. I feel lucky to be sober. I feel very honored to be up here today, and you know, I feel like I've made a lot of friends here this weekend. Everywhere I go that AA is, I already have friends. That's, you know, I already have friends. And you can test that out, you know. You can test that out. I was in Cincinnati once on a... I was there overnight to do a professional thing, and I was terrified. And I called AA, and I said, I'm in this big hotel on the river, and I need a meeting, and I've been sober less than a year, and I need some help. And guy got off the phone, he came back, and he said, a guy named John in an old white Cadillac will meet you at the back door in 10 minutes. It was great. Here he was. And you know, I got all the AA I needed. I was desperate to get back to the hotel by the time, because I hadn't had any supper. Anyway, this has been a great thing for me. One of my enemy in AA, in my life, is my own ego, not other people. My enemy is in here, and it has to do with my mind, my ego, playing all kinds of tricks on me. Myself, which is deeper, which I hope is where I'm talking from, can't be there unless I can get that ego thing out of the way. And you know, to stand up in front of people with a microphone is very seductive to the old ego. And so I've asked myself a lot of questions about this, and I gave myself a hard time about it. And I thought, you know, what are you doing this to yourself for? This is a wonderful thing to get to do, and it really is. And I hope that that everybody in here, sometime or other, will have the chance to stand up in front of a, you know, the fear of public speaking is ranked higher than the fear of death. You know, it is, in terms of what people are afraid of. And you know, to do something like this, because I feel it right in here, and I want to thank y'all. It's really been great.